6. Since Turl seemed to be working on other things than teleportation, which was the key to this entire dilemma, Johnny, for the time being, turned his attention to other things. He had not entirely lost hope of unraveling the cyclotechnology through the restoration and possible cooperation of the remaining cyclos. If he could get the two pieces of metal out of the head of a trained cyclo engineer, there was a possibility that some of these mysteries would be solved, and solved, they would leave them in better control of the planet's future. Dr. McKendrick had returned. One or two of the African-based people had come down with a touch of what McKendrick said was malaria carried by mosquitoes. McKendrick had procured cinchona bark from South America and had made them mop up standing pools of water in the base and put nets over the air intake vents, and all that seemed to be under control. McKendrick's three remaining cyclo patients, two of whom were rated engineers, were not, however, so easily handled as the malaria. They were not getting well. They remained barely alive. The 33 live cyclos from the American compound arrived in Africa without incident and were put in a prepared dorm section. They had been duly reported as lost at sea in a plane crash. But the doctor did not have much hope for it. "I have tried every way I can think of," he told Johnny one evening in his underground African surgery, "and one can't get through the intricate skull structure to the items without severely damaging it. Every cyclo cadaver I have worked with so far plainly shows that critical skull bone joints would be very damaged and vital brain nerves would be severed. Those things were put into the soft skull of a newborn pup, and even within a few months, the skull would have been hardened to a point where they could not be removed. I will go on working with cyclocadavers, but I cannot hold out any real hope." Johnny wandered off from the conference, trying to think of some solution to that problem. It seemed these days he had a lot more problems than he had solutions. He felt that if he didn't come up with some solutions fairly soon, the human race might well be a write-off. He heard his name called. He was passing by one of the doors that housed the new cyclo arrivals, and he stopped and went over. There was a small viewport and an intercom inset into the door panel. It was Chirk. He had never had anything against Chirk. A rattle-brain and dedicated to wrong conclusions, though she might be, the times when he had seen her, they had not fought.
"Johnny," said Chirk, "I just want to thank you for saving us."
Johnny realized somebody had been talking to the cyclos. Maybe Donald Dean.
"When I think of what that awful Turl planned to do, murder us all, you know, ooh, my fur crackles. I always thought you were kind of cute, Johnny. You know that? So I know you saved our lives."
Johnny said, "You're welcome. Can I do anything for you?" She looked pretty forlorn, really. No clothes, but a wraparound. Fur all matted.
"No," said Chirk. "Just thank you."
Johnny walked off and was halfway down the passage before the weirdness of it struck him. A cyclo being thankful? Expressing appreciation? Not wanting something? Impossible. He had never had much to do with female cyclos. They were not numerous in the company. But a grateful cyclo? Never. He acted fast. 10 minutes later, they had a mineral analyzer rigged and Chirk's head in it. 20 minutes of investigation, and they had an answer. Chirk did not have any bronze object in her head. She did have a silver capsule, but it was of different shape and size. There were 12 females from the American compound, and after a great deal of hustle and bustle and assembly line treatment, they had established that none of the females had a bronze object in their brains, but they did have silver ones of the same pattern as Chirk's. Two pilots took off for the morgue in the clouds, accompanied by a fur-wrapped McKendrick, and they soon established, working in the icy blast of a keen wind, that they had 3 females in that lot. That night, McKendrick held out the different capsule to Johnny and Angus. He had removed it from the female corpse that had been brought back. Careful examination showed it to have a less complex internal filament, but that was all they could tell.
"I don't think that could be cut out either," said Dr. McKendrick. "The structure of the female skull is even more complicated than the male's. All I can contribute is that it probably puts out a different message when activated."
That seemed to be pretty well that. However, the bronze cruelty factor was missing in a female, so the following morning Johnny had another talk with Chirk.
"How would you like a job?" said Johnny.
"Well, that would be wonderful." It just showed he was cute. Because she couldn't go back to Cyclo now. Turl had ruined her company record, and they would never re-employ her with the black marks of disobedience all over the file. And if he promised not to send her back to Cyclo and paid her usual wage of 200 galactic credits a month, a job would be a very good thing, for she was going mad from inactivity and no cosmetics. For a long time now, they had been taking galactic credits out of company payroll offices, out of the wallets of dead Cyclos, out of canteen cash drawers, and they had a couple of million credits kicking around. So it was feasible. They struck a bargain. Loosed with a breathe mask and a sentry, Chirk promptly found a few yards of cloth in supply, was escorted down to the lake, and, oblivious of crocodiles, took a bath. She then demanded access to the minerals sample room of the compound. She got some white gypsum, put it in a mortar, and finally pulverized it, and put it in a sample bag. She threw some copper in a retort, added some acid, boiled it all away, washed the residue, and mixed it with some clear motor grease. She put it in a can. She got some tractor paint out of the storeroom, deepened its color to a brilliant purple by boiling it, and added simple stain dye, and then poured in a pungent thinner. She put the last in a bottle. Then she went to the tailor shop and slashed and annealed dress uniform cloth. She took some seat covering and cut it and annealed it into a pair of flare-topped boots and demanded to be taken back to her room. Shortly, there emerged the most stylish female a Cyclo Street had ever seen. Although the breathe mask hid the face makeup, one supposed that it was there for morale. And if you looked closely through the leaded faceplate, you could see that she had brilliant green lip bones, a glaring white nose bone, and white and green circles around her eye bones. Her claws were a glaring shade of purple. The white dress uniform cloth was topped with a flaring gold collar and bound about by a gold-colored belt, and her boots were gold with purple sole lines. Chirk then demanded access to another room where the other females were kept, and thereafter the current base commander was besieged with demands for more contracts at 200 galactic credits a month, and clothes. Although Johnny had not really expected much help from that quarter, he got it unexpectedly. Shortly he would get trouble, but to begin with, it was revelatory. Chirk made a trip out to find some mud. In that area, there was lots of mud, but she was looking for a certain kind of mud. She chattered away at Angus as they tramped about. She was carrying a 200-pound scope under her arm like it was a handbag. Johnny saw them walking around the edge of a swamp, Angus dwarfed by the 800-pound female, two sentries following, mostly in case of wild beasts. Johnny went over to them. She was looking for mud. She would stick in a paddle and put a dab on the scope plate and shake her head and walk on. She didn't seem to be getting anywhere. Johnny noticed something odd in animal behavior. When he went out, the game ignored him. But, Chirk, you couldn't see game as far as you could look. Not an elephant, not a lion, no deer, nothing. He reasoned it must be the smell of a Cyclo. Where once animals fled at the smell of a man, over the centuries they had transferred their survival instincts. They wouldn't let a Cyclo within miles of them. Still, this area hadn't been hunted out, and neither had any other area.
"Oh, Cyclo men don't mass hunt," said Chirk, busy with her paddle and scope. "The silly things find just one animal and follow it, and then they sit around in a circle and take 3 days to kill it little by little. So they don't often get 3 days off. Not in this company. Silly things, males.
Johnny did not enlighten her as to what made them silly. After a while, she found her mud. She filled a mine bucket with it and easily carried the 200-pound scope and the 400 pounds of mud back to the compound. She put the mud in glass bottles and added some green liquid goo food, and then rinsed the mud out. She handed the bottles to McKendrick, who gazed at them in mystery.
Chirk said, "Put that in the wounds, you foolish creature. How can you expect them to heal up if you don't use a countervirus? Any child knows that."
McKendrick got it. His treatments were all aimed at bacterial control on beings who were basically virus-structured. Within the next 3 days, all his cyclo patients began to get well. Their festering wounds closed, and it appeared they were going to have 3 completely cured ones soon. Chirk got to work on the library. It shocked her that the volumes were so strewn about, and for 2 days she did nothing but collect cyclo books into huge piles. The other females helped, and also began to clean up large areas of old cyclo berthings. Johnny was working one day in the old cyclo operations room when Chirk suddenly presented herself.
"Your library," she said, "is in disgraceful condition. According to company regulations, certain book lists must be in every mine site, and you can see by this form that the manager here has been negligent and should be given a black mark on his record. But I am working for you now, so I must call to your attention Form 2,345,980A. If you place this order with Cyclo, they will send them out on the next shipment. It is a very serious matter, an incomplete library."
Chirk might not be in present time about the company, but she certainly had filled out the form. Johnny hadn't even known the form existed, and he found himself staring at one item checked as missing. War vessel recognition tables of hostile races, and another, individual troop combat capabilities cataloged by alien races. Chirk went back to work putting books in order on shelves, but within minutes, Johnny had 30 people, including 2 pilots, ransacking the place. The visitors upstairs could be identified, and some means of defense might exist. Sir Robert had returned from Scotland that morning, and it was he who guessed it.
"Johnny, that group here didn't know who was attacking. Anyone in command here would have been tearing through those books. Have you looked on the corpses?"
That's where they were, in a shoulder bag on the body of a former mine manager up in the snow. Not more than 3 hours later, comparing his own and Stormalong's pictures and the texts, he knew he was dealing with Tallneps, Hockners, Balbods, and Hawthins. And he knew what they looked like and what their capabilities were. All dangerously nasty. There was no listing for the globe-shaped ship with the ring around it, or any race of small gray men. But the following day, his luck ran out with Chirk. She had been doing very well, but he made a mistake. She was sitting, all 800 pounds of her, at a desk in the library making some lists. Johnny was looking at a sheet of figures he had drawn up. The sheet concerned distances from Earth to various hostile bases nearest to it, and the speeds of the types of alien ships. They had different types of drives. For the most part, they ran on energy accumulated from suns, but they handled it differently. He was trying to calculate how many months those ships were from their relative bases. Turl's lists of inhabited planets had now been copied off in sheet form, and it was evident they didn't include all systems or suns, but only those in which Cyclo had an interest. Johnny had been amazed to find in other texts that there were 400 billion suns in this galaxy alone, and that this universe contained more than 100 billion galaxies. And he had 16 universes to look at. The possible bases of hostile peoples were easier to mentally encompass. From Earth to this galaxy's center was about 30,000 light-years, and one light-year was about 6 trillion miles. All these enemy ships exceeded the speed of light one way or another, but this still made it necessary to compute by how much they exceeded against what base where.
It was an awful lot of cycloarithmetic. He was not too patient doing it by hand. Thoughtlessly, he said to Chirk, "Could you help me add these figures up?" She looked at him, totally blank, for about a minute. Then she said,
"I don't know how."
Johnny smiled. "It's just arithmetic. Here, I'll show you." Chirk's eyes glazed. She fell forward across the desk. There was no response from her. She was totally unconscious. They had to get a forklift in and take her to her room and put her to bed. 3 days later, McKendrick told Johnny, "She's just lying there in a coma. Maybe in time she'll come out of it. She seems to have had a heavy shock." Although he felt bad about it, Johnny had an idea now of what the silver capsule in the females was. They were not to be taught any cyclomathematics, ever. The key to the whole cycloempire must be mathematics, and aside from their arithmetic, he couldn't make head or tail of their equations. It seemed to be a dead end. 7. They had just completed the installation of a radio telescope when the courier came in. Angus, his face red, first from sun at lake level, and then from wind and snow, up at the summit of nearby Mount Elgon, was very proud of himself. The German and Swedish pilots, with something to do besides strain under the relentless storm along, had helped find and install the huge reflector bowls and relays from the peaks and down to the mine site. Now that they had the frequencies, Angus was saying, they would soon be hearing everything those monkeys up there were saying to each other. He'd even have them on the screens. Johnny's ear caught the far-off approach of the plane above the overcast. He thanked Angus and the pilots and said they had done very well, and yes, now maybe they would know more about the intentions of their visitors.